Take on the program. We talk about TensorFlow. I'll begin by a personal introduction. When I was a student at the Ecole Polytechnique in Paris, we had a course in algebra, and a big chunk of this course was devoted to tensor calculus. And it seemed to me that it was pretty difficult and also shallow. I barely managed to pass the exams, and I had a bad feeling about the whole topic. Then a few years later, I was working on my PhD thesis, and I had to learn category theory. And then I discovered that there is this beautiful, well, I fell in love with universal characterizations, and I found that there is this beautiful characterization of tensor products as moving you from bilinear functions to linear functions. So this is the characterization. You have to, let's say, vector spaces, A and B. You have the tensor product here. There is a natural bilinear function here. And given any x here and any bilinear function here, there is a unique linear function which makes the diagram coherent. Okay, so I found that that was really a neat idea. Then, well, I became interested in logics, in non-monotonic logics. I was shown that the quantum logic is some specific non-monotonic logic. I was interested in quantum logic and slightly more widely in the foundations of quantum physics. And then I realized certainly that one of the basic construction there is the tensor product. Still a big mystery for me, at least. Why is it that the tensor product is the right construction to represent a composite system composed of two subsystems? And then I read about the works of Samson and colleagues and students, and I noticed with pleasure that they also thought that tensor product was a very fundamental thing. And then I tried to read their papers, was sure that I was going to really understand why this universal characterization is really the key to understanding why tensor product is the right thing. Well, lo and behold, you know, they don't use this characterization. Okay? They go to an abstract view where tensor product is a name for monoidal symmetric operation. So my question was, where has this universal characterization gone? And could we bring it back? Okay, so I understand, and I think I agree with Samson and others, that we don't want to talk about a specific category. We don't want to talk about Hilbert spaces. We want a language in which we can talk about many different categories, which would be like Hilbert spaces or like quantum physics, or so that we have a wider scope. Okay, so the reason, so why can't we describe that construction in an abstract way, more general, in, let's say, any category, or almost any category? Well, thinking about it, the reason appears very clearly why it's difficult, at least, to do that. It's because there is this notion of a bilinear function here, which, well, it's not an arrow, certainly, so it's not a morphism. So what is it? Okay, so the problem is to generalize, first problem is to generalize this idea of a function, a morphism of two domains. So that's what I'm going to try to do. Okay. So what's the rough idea? rough ideas. We are going to call them bimorphisms. I think the term has been used other by, for another purpose in categories already, but I hope it's not going to bother you too much. So we are going to try to describe beasts like that, which have two domains, A and B, and one codomain X. Okay, so what's the obvious way we want to do it? We take, obviously, our cues from vector spaces or from sets. And the idea, well, we need an arrow for every element of A, we need an arrow from B to X. And for every element of B, we need an arrow from A to X. Okay, so for every little a in big A, we want an arrow from B to X. For every little b in big B, F2, we want an arrow from A to X. And essentially, you see, F is going to be a pair like that in F1, F2. Okay? That's looks good, except that there are two problems here. First problem is, is that enough, or do we need another property? But looking at sets, for example, you see that you do need another property. It's not just that. You also need to make sure that you, if you apply F first to A and then to B, and or first to B and then to A, you should get the same result. You should get F of A and B. So in sets, for example, what you want is F1 of A. You see, it's an arrow from B to X, so it's a function from B to X. So if you apply it to B, that should be F of A B. And similarly, F2 of B, for any B applied to A, should also be F of A B. So that's another condition. Certainly, we need the condition like that. And the last problem is what's little a to big A? Okay? So, but now, there is the natural thing to do is to consider what Sampson calls points here. Okay? We will have to work relative to some object I, okay? And relative to this object I, any arrow from I to A, okay, these are the points, the elements of A that we are looking for. So the idea is, now I'll give you the definition of a bimorphism respective relative to A.
This one was wrong.
You need somebody smaller than I.
And all the rest is to begin with.
Thank you. So, here's the definition of bimorphism. Of by, let's say, A, B, X. So this relative respective to A, to R. Okay? So it's a pair, F1, F2. F1 is a function from every A of type I to big A, which will give you F1 of A, which will be an arrow from B to X, and F2, which is a function which to every B, which is from I to B, will give you F2 of B, which will be from A to X, such that, so that's the condition. Turns out that the translation of the condition, which is below here, is very simple. It's a commutation condition. We just want F for every A, for every B, F1 of A B, so first you do B and then you do F1 of A, that should be the same as doing F2 of B after A. Okay? So that looks nice. That's first good thing. So you can check that, for example, in set, this really defines you functions of two variables, and in vector spaces, it really defines you a binomial function. Okay. Now, let's talk about composition. If we have those bimorphisms, we'll need to compose them. Well, that's a big mistake. I'm not trying to say composition. Well, composition, we are not going to compose bimorphisms, one bimorphism with another one. We are going to compose bimorphisms with morphisms, and all works very well. I use Greek letters for the bimorphisms, Latin letters for morphisms. So, for example, you can do some bimorphism first, and then some morphism. Okay, it's like that. Okay. And or you can do here first some kind of pair of morphisms on the right, and then beta, and you get something like that. So they are very easy to define. There is no problem. And so you see, for example, here you will just define f the g one to be f one. Sorry, beta and gamma. Okay, this is binary. We define gamma 1 to be f beta 1, then gamma 2 to be f beta 2, and you can check that all the rules about composition that you could would like to have, they are right. Okay, so everything goes right. Okay. Now we can define the tensor product relative always to I. Okay. So the tensor product is exactly what you would expect. So given A and B objects, a tensor product would be an object A times B with a natural or A morphism, bimorphism AB into A times B, which has exactly the right universal property for every X and every bimorphism of this type. There is a unique morphism which makes the diagonal commute. We have defined composition here. So, for example, now there are categories which have tensor products. For example, if it all depends on I also, so this is all relative respective to I. So if you look at sets and functions and you take a singleton, then there is a tensor product. If you look vector space and the base field, then is a tensor product. Okay. Now the question is, what can we prove out about this tensor product? And obviously, because it's all respective to I, we haven't said anything about I. obviously we can't prove so much. It's very surprising that we can prove many things without any assumption about I. So first, this tensor product has a functorial character. It's really a functor. And that has nothing to do with the properties of I. Okay, so if you have A prime A, that's F, and G, then there is a narrow F times G from A prime times B prime to A times B. And, okay, I'll show you how this is defined. And I'll just show that here. So we'll use the universal property of A prime B prime. So what? So this will be the unique arrow which will make a certain diagram commute. So the diagram that we have, we need here a bimorphism A from A prime B prime into A B. But okay, we have the standard canonical morphism from A B to A times B. I want to give it a name. I'll call it alpha of A B. Okay? So we'll just use as this morphism, the morphism which uses alpha of A B, and then the pair F G. So, using this definition, you really can prove that it preserves both identities and composition. So, we have a functor. We also have symmetry. Okay, that's built in this definition. Again, without any assumption about R. I mean here that A times B is isomorphic to B times A. That follows from the following remark. Suppose we have a bimorphism beta from A, B to X. Okay. Beta is beta 1, beta 2. By definition, we can define a morphism beta bar, which is, will be beta 2, beta 1. So that's a morphism from B, A into X. And easy to see that it is indeed a bimorphism. You can notice that beta bar is beta. You can notice that it's okay with the bar behaves as you would expect with respect to composition. So F beta bar is really F beta bar. And now you look at the form, you consider alpha of BA, which that's the canonical morphism, which is the bimorphism BA into BA. And now you look at its bar, alpha BA bar, and that's going to be the morphism from AB into B. A times A, and you can using the universal properties of alpha, you can easily show that you have in that, okay. You have here the alpha into A times A. You have this other one, which is, let's say, alpha bar into B times A. So there is a unique morphism which makes all the thing commute. And it also goes the other way. So you see easily that there are isomorphisms. So we have symmetry for nothing. The question is, well, do we have more? What about the unit? Is it a unit object? Well, obviously, it's not true in general. You need certainly some properties about I to make sure that we have, if we want to have I times A, isomorphic to A. Turns out that there are some nice, very natural properties about I that will make that all true. So I'm going to describe those properties. So there are really two. The first one is the most important one. So the intuition is those morphisms S from I to I, they are the scalars. Okay, and scalar multiplication should be global. Okay, so that's what we are going to ask here. It's a property of monoidal symmetric categories. For every object A, for every scalar S, okay, S is a scalar number, so there should be an endo arrow on A which multiplies by S. Okay, so they exist SA, which is an arrow from A to A, such that now, so for every point little a in big A, you can do little a after multiplying by S, or first do A and then multiply by SA, that should be the same thing. So that's a nice property for I. You easily check that the one-point set has this property in set, because there is only one arrow like that, and also the scalars have this property in vector space. So the second property that we want, I think, was mentioned in Rostock. We want I to be not too small, so that should be enough points in every object A. So we are going to write it this way: for every AB, for every FG, which are parallel arrows from A to B, if they are different, then they should exist a point in A which makes the difference, such that so what I want is A first and then F should be different from G F. Okay. Okay, so those two conditions are reasonably natural. Conditions are reasonably natural, and they already have very important consequences. So we'll go slow. First, scalars act globally. That I mean, if you have a diagram A, B, F here, and then here SA to A, and you have here F again, B, and you have here SB, and this commutes. And this is easy to see. You just add one arrow here, arbitrary arrow here, A, and then by arrow chasing, the two things you get are the same. And if it's true for every A, by the second condition, then there must be the same arrows. Okay? Other property of scalars is that they act as you would expect with respect to bimorphisms. So if you have a bimorphism F, which is F1, F2, then if you look at F1 of AS, this is going to be F1 of A times SB. Same thing for F2. 2 BS is now going to be 2 BSB. Okay, the proof. How much time do you have?
Quite a lot, actually, almost 20 minutes. Okay.
So the proof is not very difficult. I'm not going to. Do you want to see the proof?
Yeah.
What?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so look at F1. AS B. To prove that, we are going to multiply by B on the left and show that for every B we have they are equal, and then by the condition 2, that's the idea of the proof. So here I do only part of it, okay? So here, by the property of the those bifunctors, this really is like F2 of B, AS. Okay? Now, I can commute there, so that's F2 of B, S, sorry, just A. A? And because of the globality of the scalars, this is really Sx, F2b, A, and this is Sx. Now, by the property of the bifunctors, bimorphism, sorry, it's F1 of A, B, and okay, so and this you can pass the S by the global property of scalars. You can pass. So how's it go now? Okay, so sorry. So we have shown that F1. A. So, okay, that's for every B. Okay, so now we use this condition. If it's true for every B, F1 of AS is equal to SX F1 of A. And then you pass the scalar on the other side, and that works. Okay. More consequences. Okay. In the definition of in the properties, yeah. In this property, you see, I assume the existence of some SA. Now, the second property implies that this SA is really unique. So SA is unique, here is the proof. Why have we A in S S A? A and suppose we have two, but we wouldn't have that. S one A A. So those two things have to be equal to every A, therefore. The identity on I is really 1, so that the identity on I, A, transported on A, is the identity on A, and works also for composition. STA is equal to STA. S is equal to SI. This is the case A is equal to I. Okay, when you transform I to I, you don't change anything. And the homset or composition of the homset A II is commutative. Okay?
So those are things you're proving.
What?
Those are things that you prove.
Yes. All the proofs are just in the same spirit, so I'm not going to go over it. But it's just arrow chasing using whenever you need this property to get boring the arrow. Okay. Now, from though, once we have proved all that, we can also show really this equation. So I is really the unit object. So I'm going to this is assuming those two properties for I. Okay. I'm not sure I'm going to go over all the proof. I'll give you the idea. The idea is we have the canonical bimorphism alpha IA from IA into I times A. Now I will first build the bimorphism from IA into A. Okay, then I will say there is a unique arrow that makes the diagonal commute, and then I will prove that it has an inverse. Okay. So how do I define this beta here? Okay, the natural way of defining beta here is the following. Beta will be beta 1, beta 2. And I have to define beta 1. So beta 1 of S, okay, S is a scale, so it's from I to I. So that should be some arrow from A to A. Okay, the one we were going to pick is exactly this one, which is provided here. So this will be SA, which is an arrow from A to A. Beta 2 of, now, I need an A here. So A is I to A. This will be, and what do I need here? I need an arrow from I to A. Okay, so I take A. Okay, now I check that that's a good definition. That's really a bimorphism. I need to check the commutation property, but so the commutation property just is that, okay, for every S, for every A, you must have a beta 1 S A, right, must be equal beta 2 A S. Okay, the beta 1 S is S A, beta 2 A is A, and that works. So we have a good functor, sorry, we have a good bimorphism here. So we have a unique arrow here. Okay. Call it M. Okay, now I need an arrow to go in the other direction. So here I'm not going to be able to, it's not from a tensor product, so I have to be a little bit imaginative. I need, okay. So I need an arrow L from A. Okay, so the way I will choose it is I take alpha 1, the alpha is this guy. Of IA at S. No, sorry. That's the identity. Okay. So then it's a bit of arrow chasing. It's long, but it's not very difficult to prove that ML is the identity on A and LM is the identity. Okay. Now, so we have at least two of the basic properties of symmetric monoids. What about the third one, which is perhaps the most important one, the associativity? So, for associativity, I don't think that those conditions are enough to ensure associativity. It may be the case, but I will show you what really is needed. Before we do that, in fact, I want to talk about the notion of product points in a tensor product. Think about linear algebra. That's an important notion also in physics. It's an important notion. Okay? Certain points in the tensor product are different from others, okay? There are those which are product states. They represent products of, let's say, uncorrelated systems, and others are different. So how does that show up here? Well, consider the tensor product A times B. So here I'm talking about product points. even cancer. So the product in this tensor product is going to be an arrow from I into this object. Now, certain arrows factor either through A or through B, and in fact, they are exactly the same. So certain arrows like that, for the X, are of the following type. They can be described so X is the product point if here there exists an A, I to A, and B, I to B, such that X is equal to, okay, alpha 2 of A, B, A, B, sorry, of B composed of A. Equivalently, by the properties of biomorphism, we could write also X equals alpha 1 of A, B, of A, B, okay, because those two things are the same. So those points are those which really come from one point in A and one point in B. One property of those product points is, like you would expect in from linear spaces, they are dense in a sense in the tensor product. So, bullet points are dense. A times B, meaning if we have two arrows F and G from the tensor product AB into some X, and if for every product point AX from I into A times D, we have FX equals X, then F equals. Now, I'm just introducing this property, well, first it could be useful in its own sake, but also it will explain a little bit about the property that I need to ensure associativity of the tensor product. So first of all, conclusion, it's striking to me at least that seems that symmetry and unicity or the property of I are more fundamental, more basic than associativity. So it, in a sense also, associativity is very natural. I think it's natural from the physical point of view, that if you have a system which is composed of three subparts, doesn't, shouldn't matter which way you compose. But perhaps it's not completely obvious. So, so you see, because really you have to describe the entanglement between three different systems, and it's not obvious that from first principles that you could do that, it's equivalent that you could reduce that by studying the entanglement of two systems and then the entanglement of the two subsystem with the third one, and that you could do in either way. But so it strikes me that associativity is less obvious or natural than the other properties.
We should finish soon.
Okay, so let I just say word about associativity. So, associativity, we ask or we would like A times B times C to be isomorphic to A times B times C. Okay. So I think, as I said, that another condition is necessary, and it turns out to be the following condition. We suppose we have the following situation. We have something which is almost a bimorphism between AB, A times B, C, and X. It's an almost bimorphism in the sense that for every point in C, we have an arrow from AB to X, but we don't have an arrow from C to X for every point in A times B, but only for the product points. Okay? And they satisfy the usual commutation condition. So we have something which is almost a bimorphism.
Bimorphism.
My tongue may have slipped, right? But this is an almost bimorphism because alpha, or let's call it gamma one, is defined. It should be defined for every point in the tensor product, but in fact, it's defined only for the product points. So the question is, can I extend that to full bimorphism? Can I extend this definition to every point?
Okay.
And respect the commutativity property. So if this is the case, if I am in a category where this is the case, I can show that there is indeed an associative. I don't know whether this condition follows from what I have written down. I doubt it. There may be a nice condition on I that would ensure that. Okay, but that's where I stand. I don't know how to do it.
One quick question.
Well, just a comment, really. I mean, your second condition there, which has played a large role in the talk, I mean, it's a well-known thing. I mean, it says that I is a generator, or that, as one says in the points terminology, that the category is well-pointed.
Yeah.
And it means that the functor, the Hom functor from I, is going to be a faithful functor into set, so that your category looks like some kind of category of structured sets and functions. So it's a very strong axiom, I mean, just to make that point. And it may lose examples of interest. For example, in the topos that Andreas was telling us about, I mean, the spectral pre-sheaf, which plays an important role in their theory, has no points. So, and yet it has many interesting morphisms on it. So it won't really cover that kind of example. So, I mean, it's just a sort of comment about where you
know. Well, that's a very interesting comment, because I think this, in fact, doesn't play a very big role in what I'm doing. It's nice because it guarantees the unicity of the SA.
Using it a lot for these proofs.
Right. But I, it could, in my opinion, okay, could probably be replaced by some coherence assumption. I made without any coherence assumptions because everything is unique here. But so if you don't have that, probably you need some coherence assumption, but it may be the case that most of what I've done goes through.
It's just also a comment that if you search in the literature for the word multi-category or representable multi-category, I think you'll find most of the things that you want.
Uh-huh.
Actually, in terms of tensor product and morphisms that are defined in multiple objects.
How do you call it?
It's called a multi-category.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's thank you again.